Welcome to Library Voices SC. This is Curtis Rogers, Communications Director at the South Carolina State Library, and I'm very happy to have with me today, via the telephone, James Kibler, and he is the author of a book we recently had a book talk for at the South Carolina State Library, our speaker at the Center Series. And his book is called Taking Root, The Nature Writing of William and Adam Summer of Pomeria. And just a little bit about James. He attended the University of South Carolina for undergrad and also for his PhD, which is in English. And his dissertation was on Faulkner. And he was an English professor at the University of Georgia. And he's also the author of 5 novels and a volume of poetry called Poems from Scorched Earth. And all of these have environmental themes. So we're very happy to have him on the phone today. So welcome, James.
Thank you.
So your book, Taking Root, The Nature Writing of William and Adam Summer of Pomeria. How did all this come about?
Well, back in about 1973, my cousin took me to Pomeria Plantation, which is on the Columbia side of Pomeria, the little village, the town. And it was Christmas, and I had always wanted to see the old house. I love old houses. It's another of my interests.
Uh-huh.
And... My cousins took me there. Miss Marie Summer Huggins, the grandniece of the two authors, William and Adam Summer. She was something, I guess, around 80 years old, and she was living there, I think, by herself at the time, in the old house. And mm-hmm. She took me on a tour of the house, which... As a young person interested in old houses, it was a very special visit. It was Christmas time, and she had a big fire in the fireplace, and the house smelled of cedar and holly that she had gotten from the woods around. And she showed me the earthquake crack, the zigzag crack in the parlor.
Oh, wow.
And said she had not plastered it over because it was basically a reminder of the Charleston earthquake of 1886.
Hmm.
This far north from Charleston. And the house was pretty much as William and Adam Summer had known it when they were growing up there.
Mm-hmm.
They were born in 1815 and 1818. So as the grandniece of these two, she had this family, this special family narrative.
Mm-hmm.
And when we went upstairs to the big hall, she pointed out the two long walls lined with books from floor to ceiling. And she said, on this side of the hall are Mr. Williams' books, and on this side of the hall are Mr. Adams' books.
Wow.
And I was amazed. I had never seen a library such as that in private hands. Probably, I'm estimating at least 10,000 books.
Wow, that's
probably
amazing.
Probably more. And I was interested in books. You see, I was studying literature, and mm-hmm. I noticed on the walls a whole series of Herman Melville novels. And I had just been teaching Melville's Typee, and there it was in its gilt-stamped spine binding. And I didn't take it off the shelf or ask to, because I was trying to have good manners. But if I only had, I later learned that Adam Summer knew Herman Melville. He was a part of the Young America movement, and he knew people like Sims and Poe and Melville. Just pretty amazing.
Wow.
So if I had only looked, they may have been presentation copies. Since that time, these copies have disappeared, and the books have been dispersed. So all this piqued my interest at the time, and I wondered who were these people? Who is William Sumner? They founded the Pomeria Nursery in around 1835, 1840. And I was interested in plants. I was part of the Friends of the Botanical Garden at the University of Georgia. And so I looked at the ledgers of orders for the nursery in, I think it was 1859. I couldn't believe such a document existed. It was on William Sumner's desk in the parlor.
Wow.
And I remember Miss Marie saying, and he looked out over this desk onto 5 acres of roses.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, the nursery sold over 500 cultivars of repeat blooming roses in 1854. We've since found a broadside listing them. But I wondered, why did this man spend so much time with plants? Is this worth a grown man's time to do this? Who were William and Adam Sumner? So anyway, that's that 1973 visit piqued my interest, and I started in my spare time trying to find things out about them. Trying to put pieces of the puzzle together to find out who these people were and why they spent so much time with plants and literature. Adam Sumner began his career as a poet. The two brothers edited 4 different periodicals during their lifetime. They were all agricultural-based, like the Southern Agriculturist, the South Carolina Agriculturist, the Carolina Farmer and Planter. But also, Adam wrote short stories and poetry, and that interested me a lot. Didn't know at the time he was part of the Young America movement, but that was something I found particularly intriguing because I was working with William Gilmore Sims, and that's really, I guess, one of my specialties. I'm a Sims scholar, and I found that Adam and William Gilmore Sims worked together, knew each other, were members of the legislature together, were fellow editors together, corresponded. Sims, in fact, was the first to publish one of Adam Sumner's poems, which I've included in this edition. So all these things were beginning to converge. It took me 40 years to start putting this, starting to put this detective work together into something that could be useful to people and interesting to people. I didn't know if it would be, but I found in reading Adam and William Sumner 600 essays, which
that's amazing.
Essays and notes. I've done a bibliography. Their works total 600, and I started reading them, and I said, my goodness, they're both good writers, very good writers. You can see that Adam began his career as a poet. Poetic phrases, memorable lines. And then what were these essays about? Well, very, I guess you'd say, trendy, topical now, sustainability in agriculture. Sustainability in farming, gardening. I amazingly current sounding. So these essays that I've collected in Taking Root, many of them touch on farming and gardening in what I call a pre-Monsanto world.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to divest and reclaim after mismanaged stewardship, because they hadn't experienced it. I mean,
mm-hmm. Right.
they're pre-Monsanto, so they don't have to clean themselves up.
Right,
they're
exactly.
They're already clean. They're pure. So when they give advice to young farmers on how to set up a farm, they're doing it from a pre-Monsanto, pre-petrochemical, based agriculture.
Right, just natural and environment. And you know, I'm looking through the table of contents, and some of these titles are just amazing. And I'll just read a few so people
Please.
Can kind of understand what they wrote about. But for instance, here's The Forest Trees of the South. And then that's number one. Then there's Forest Trees of the South. Number two, The Live Oak. And there are sections on cherries and China berries and Chinese sugar cane. And I think a lot of people, you know, kind of know about these things, but don't really understand, you know, the basics. They've even got something in here called Frankincense, a humbug and cure for saddle galls. I mean, you know, I think today many people have no idea what that is, but it's just fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've chosen some good ones. I like the essay on Jerusalem artichokes.
Okay.
trendy again. They call them sunchokes now.
Uh-huh.
But I was noticing a farm-to-table program on ETV, and it was featuring sunchokes. And this essay on the Jerusalem artichoke is extremely important. So they're important for us as practical information, but also historically important. That may be one of the earliest essays you can find on Jerusalem artichokes and how wise what he has to say. They don't give you essays on things they have not done. In other words, mm-hmm. before they give advice or give explanations, they have done it. They were practical farmers as well as writers and editors, very much like Wendell Berry is. If you know Mr. Berry's work, he in fact wrote the preface to this edition, and I treasure those pages in which he really understands quite well what the practical advice and the practical farming techniques that the Summer Brothers had is beneficial, how that is beneficial to the modern reader. So totally relevant today, I think. And of course, I had to choose from the 600 essays and notes, and I had only space for 100.
Mm-hmm.
So what I tried to do is give a sampling of all their interests, like setting up a farm. How do you set up a farm?
Mm-hmm.
How do you landscape your family cemetery? That's one of my favorite essays. It's an essay on family cemeteries.
Exactly. I just happen to be looking at it right now. Neglect of family cemeteries. And they have other things like the United States Patent Office Reports and Government Impositions. I like that one.
Right. That's by Adam Summer. He understood the bureaucracy that was burgeoning at the time and how that disconnect between the bureaucracy in Washington with the farmer himself and herself, he was seeing how much money is wasted and how they should really ask the farmers to be in charge of these bureaus. The patent office at that time also included the farm sphere.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's called the patent office. In an agricultural context, there was no agricultural department at the time. So, I think I should have had probably two volumes, but we were trying to see how the first how these first 100 essays might do. It's expensive to do a book nowadays, and USC Press put the money up, you know, and they've got to sell books. So we wanted to see how this first 100 would how the audience for that book would meet it, and maybe I could do another volume if it's popular enough, but I don't really foresee it. I think what their legacy is, well, the most important thing that these two men accomplished, besides saying you've got to stop this business of one crop systems, you've got to be diverse in your agriculture, self-sustainable, independent farms, et cetera, et cetera. They really did not like the cotton system, the rye system, and they said it over and over again and got really, I think, tired of saying it because they get a little shrill sometimes.
Sure,
talking about land abuse and so forth. But their real legacy is an environmental ethic, and I had not encountered such an environmental ethic any earlier than theirs. I knew the writings of Thoreau, Henry David Thoreau. Of course, I know John Muir, but these men were writing in advance of Thoreau, and that caused me to think. And I started exploring so-called environmental literature, and they're among the first in America. And their environmental ethic, that the essays that I've chosen will show you, unfolding for you, is an amazingly current one, so that the protection of trees, the replanting of gullied landscapes, the desire to have sort of a quilt-like patchwork landscape instead of just long miles of cotton, all the same. I'm thinking of industrial agriculture today and what agriculture can learn from William and Adam Summer of diversity, not 2,000 acres of safflowers, cotton,
right, just cotton one crop,
or whatever, but the smaller acreage fields diverse, and of course that's what most people in the know now recommend, and they were saying the same thing, and they were saying it before all the, I guess you'd say, poor stewardship, the results of poor stewardship is made apparent to us. They predict, in other words, they're prophets. They say, if you keep on doing this, this is what you're going to have. And it's what we have. Soil loss, erosion, on and on and on. All the problems. So as far as farming goes, I think they're extremely important in their environmental ethic. Well, landscape architecture, they didn't just sell the practical apples and pears and peaches, by the way, over 1,000 named varieties in their catalogs.
Wow, that's amazing. And you know,
it is amazing. And they were interested in ornamentals, as we were talking about the roses, but Adam Summer was a particular champion of native plants. And so when we were talking about a dust jacket for this book, I suggested Audubon's Mourning Dove. In the background is the Stewardia malachidendron. Doesn't have a common name. It's called the Stewardia.
Mm-hmm.
And Adam's first catalog for the nursery in 1852 listed the Stewardia for sale. It's a rare native plant. It's hard to find even from a rare plant nursery. But he was a particular champion of plants like the serviceberry tree, the hemlock, the Magnolia grandiflora, of course,
mm-hmm.
The silver bell tree, the native azaleas, he said, and all the hues of the rainbow. So these men were specialists in a certain way, but Renaissance men. And I like that about them. They ranged. They didn't just do the practical crops. They were interested in the beauty of the landscape.
Mm-hmm.
I love Adam's comment. He said, of all the things in the landscape, we should treat the trees most specially. In other words, trees were a big deal. For him, you highlighted that series, Trees of the South.
Mm-hmm.
It is one of my favorites, too. And the Magnolia grandiflora was the tree, of course, they said was sort of God's gift to us and the South's gift to botany worldwide. It's one of the most beautiful trees in the world. The Japanese claim it is theirs. Of course, they have their own magnolias, but they will not be told that the Magnolia grandiflora is not Japanese.
Mm-hmm.
I've had arguments with them. They have plenty of magnolias, but it's not the Magnolia grandiflora, which is the grand tree. Well, Adam Summers said that. He said, this is our great gift to horticulture. And it was common only along the coast in the 1840s. You'd hardly ever see one up as far north as Columbia.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I didn't realize that, but then after I started exploring this, the Magnolia grandiflora was the tree that they said every household in the state of South Carolina should have a magnolia. And you could also, in the upper part of the state, have hemlocks. And the hemlock and the magnolia, sister trees, should embrace each other in the landscape. So they knew the Lowcountry landscape quite well. They championed the Magnolia grandiflora most particularly. And I have the records of the nursery, so I can give you a periodicity of orders. In other words, how many trees were actually ordered from the nursery? The most popular tree in 1859, 1860, was the Magnolia grandiflora.
Wow.
The second was the Deodar cedar. You find big specimens of the grandiflora and the Deodar cedar in Columbia and all over the upcountry, especially, where it loves it. So their legacy in our landscape is pretty important. I was finding that Magnolia grandiflora, say, in Winnsboro, they were not in Winnsboro before this time of the nursery. And now there are huge trees, Magnolia grandiflora. Newberry, same. I don't know about Columbia, but I do know that the patrons of Columbia ordered a lot of Magnolia grandiflora. Some of these trees, I have found them from Columbia on up into Greenville and about.
Wow.
Because I have the names of the orderers, and I find that their properties have these big magnolias and big Deodar cedars. And then I know exactly, likely, when they were ordered and planted. Abbeville has a good many. Newberry, Lawrence, well, most of the upcountry towns, because mm-hmm. they were listening to what Adam Summer had to say about the Magnolia grandiflora, the poetic way he describes. So that's a legacy of the nursery that we see on a daily basis but don't realize.
Right. And one of the things I think, as you're talking about, a lot of these things that they wrote about still hold true today. And also one of the things I found fascinating is how internationally known they were, because
yes.
There's one article or essay called New and Cheap Food for Bees. And this was something that, you know, was, I think, part of something published in Belgium. And,
that's right.
You know, it's just fascinating that here in the tiny town of Pomeria, South Carolina, these folks had this international reach.
Absolutely. They ordered from Ghent. They swapped seeds with Van Houte. If you know botany in the Latin terms, it's this Van Houtei and that Van Houtei. That's Van Houtei. That's Van Houtei. And they were on first-name basis and ordered from Van Houtei's Ghent, Belgium nurseries. So they were on the international stage. And there wasn't really a town at their time called Pomeria. The nursery, Pomeria Nurseries, finally gave the little railroad town its name. In other words, Pomeria existed before Pomeria.
Okay.
It's kind of interesting that the little village that grew up around the Greenville-Columbia Railroad took the name of the plantation, which was about two miles away. See, so this little spot on the railroad became well known all the way to Louisiana. The plants that they sold went as far as Mississippi and Louisiana, and as far as New Jersey and New York. So they sent plants via the railroad, wrapped in silk. I guess that was their plastic of the day.
Right.
So they would send a bare root plant wrapped in silk.
Wow.
And out on the railroad. So they had a fairly important role in the what I would call floriculture of the day. This, of course, before Fruitland Nursery of Augusta, which kind of eclipsed them later on as the war caused real problems at Pomeria, the war,
mm-hmm.
meaning the war between states. It fell into decline as Fruitlands, which is now Augusta National Golf Course,
mm-hmm.
that's the site of Fruitlands, that became more and more and more popular as a nursery as Pomeria declined. But Pomeria was the first, and Fruitland really never did have the sophistication that Pomeria did 20, 30 years before. Most people know that nursery. In plant circles, they know that nursery. But I was amazed. I didn't know Pomeria, and that was another one of my reasons for working with them. I wanted them to get their credit and their due, because they worked so hard and so unselfishly, so brilliantly, and nobody knew them, and still don't. But James Cawthron, in that wonderful book called Antebellum, Antebellum, Southern Antebellum Gardens, which is kind of the textbook now for gardening in the Old South.
Mm-hmm.
He names Pomeria as the first important nursery of the Lower and Middle South. So he nails it. He's got it right. And he was not able to. He died, unfortunately, a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And was not able to see this book come out, but he knew what I was doing, and he really was interested and applauded what I was working with. He came to all my lectures on Pomeria and so forth and so on. So James Cawthron's book, Antebellum Plantation Garden, what is it? I wish I could remember it right. Go online. You can find it.
All right.
Cothran's name is spelled C-O-T-H-R-A-N, and the reference to Pomeria is in that Antebellum Southern Gardens book. So it's getting, the nursery and these two brothers are getting known, but it takes so long. What you find is ruts that are real deep mm-hmm. in historicity. It takes so long for the word to get out, I guess is the way
sure.
to put it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think one way that the word will get out is to read the works the two men wrote. Because after you've read the 100 essays, you seem to know them and you like them.
Mm-hmm.
They were not stuffy. They were not what I'd call careerists. They were genuinely interested in feeding people and beautifying. And it's so clear that they love Mother Earth like their own mother,
mm-hmm.
like their own mother in the household.
Mm-hmm.
And Wendell Berry liked the fact that Adam Summers always talked about what her sons owe Mother Earth. And he has a wonderful essay on that whole concept of Mother Earth that goes back to the 12th century.
Wow.
And Adam Summer is a part of that. William Summer is a part of that long progression of environmental, what I would call environmental savviness,
mm-hmm.
of understanding what we owe, of understanding what we have to do. Because we've been given such a gift, we have to pass it on better than we found it, and
mm-hmm.
certainly not worse. I like the comment that I believe it's Adam in one of his essays says, greed is the resort of the uninspired.
Wow.
In other words, if you don't have inspiration and you don't have imagination, yeah, just go clear cut it.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, I think this book is certainly important today, and I think a lot of people will glean a lot of wonderful information from it. And it's important that it's, you know, all out and documented. I think people will really find this interesting. And again, this is Taking Root, The Nature Writing of William and Adam Summer of Pomeria. It's available from the University of South Carolina Press, and we'll have a link to that on the website. And also check your local public library and see if you can find a copy there. We have copies here at the South Carolina State Library. And I just want to thank Dr. Kibler for joining us today. We certainly do appreciate it.
Well, thank you for helping spread the word.
Well, thank you. And hopefully a lot of people will find out more about William and Adam Summer.